can't fill them up if she,
Double that, you know.
You don't have any idea how often.
I hitchhiked across from New York to Los Angeles. Now,
in 32. Why do I didn't meet you? I was hitchhiking around then too.
And hitchhiking was a terrific experience. Well, when I came to Los Angeles, at that time, it was not a union town. And Hines and his Red Squad was raining there, carried on a terrific reign of terror, actually. And, I was breaking the millinery shop. We were trying to organize millinery workers. And every time we got together, succeeded in lining up a number of workers, Red Squad smashed into the, well, we used to meet in the Union of Warriors, and break it up. So I stayed there about a year, and I went to Chicago, hitchhiked again. And the depression was very great, and in Chicago things weren't very good. Steel workers were out of work. Everybody was out of work. We starved, and we had the industrial union, kept it going, and tried to reach the youth to reinforce our ranks. Then there was big unemployment demonstrations and big meetings. And then we went to the hunger march from Chicago. Well, going to the hunger march was a battle from the start to the, from the beginning to the end. They had to break through whole cordons of state troopers, machine guns, guns pointed at us. They all broke up our comms. They fell upon us at night when we used, workers in the cities used to prepare towns, places for us to sleep in the night, gas bombs and whatnot. Then we came. We finally reached Washington. Along the line, we picked up hundreds of unemployed people who went with us, delegations. And in Washington, when we reached Washington, they shoved us in on a highway, and there were thousands by this time. All the delegations from New York and all, they all converged in one place. They shoved us in on a highway, and they naturally they were prepared to meet us with guns and machine guns. They got the Marines out, and I remember at that time some of the Marines kind of refused this sort of thing, and they were court-martialed. I don't remember. I think it was 10 or 12 men.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, this thing was at a very high pitch, and at night, started a fight that they should at least let the women go to sleep in private homes. People prepared for us in halls, and it was cold. No, they wouldn't do it. Call a mass meeting sort of amongst ourselves, and I don't know if you remember, Anna Burlap from Textile.
Oh, yeah.
She was beautiful and very militant and young and had the, and was a very fiery speaker and had a terrific appeal. And there at night, Anna Burlap addressed us, and it was so dramatic, and to me these things looked very beautiful. I somehow saw the poetry of it. And just about that time, who should be visiting in Washington? Lady Astor. And she went slumming, sightseeing. She went to see the unemployed. And she heard Anne Burlap talk, and she saw her. Oh, she said, she's the Red Rose of America. And she made a few remarks, and well, finally we fought out that the women should be placed in homes. They put us in private homes. We stayed there for some, well, about a week we were in Washington. I don't have to tell you, Hoover didn't give us anything. No matter how much we fought, next day we had a march on Capitol Hill and didn't let us in, and all right, the delegation went. But we didn't feel defeated. Even in our defeats, we felt that somewhere along the line we are going to win. On the way back, we were going back to Chicago. I don't know how the other counts got back. It became very cold, and naturally our trucks were old and they were smashed out in the rain. So I set out from a small town where all our trucks were out of water. There were a few fellows. I said, oh, well, I want to get to Pittsburgh, let's go. So hop a freight train. I already had the experience of hopping freight trains. So we walked to a railroad junction by the name of Bankomat. Now we got there by nightfall, and a lot of unemployed railroad workers took us into a railroad yard, made a fire for us, and they were very much concerned about us, and they actually surrounded us. Again, I'm a railroad engineer, and we are unemployed, all of us. And we point a hill, and they lived in caves. He said, that's where we live. We have piled up so much wealth for the railroad companies. They lived in caves. It was a frightening human tragedy. And I stood there and I cried. I felt so bad looking at the children. Then I felt it was senseless to cry. Well, and we assured them that something will come out of this march, that they ought to get together and organize. The fellows did, but I remained by myself. I was too little. I couldn't get on the train. The train was in motion. So next morning, perhaps, we have unemployment insurance, we have Social Security, we have health programs.
We still have to fight for them, though, but
they're
disappearing.
No, it doesn't mean that we can keep it without a struggle. But for whatever we have today, we struggled very hard. Not only struggled, we suffered for it. I mean, I have seen so many tragedies, so much tragedy here during the Depression that it was frightening. Now look, I was not born in this country. I'll be 51. Now in these 33 years, terrific things happened in the United States, great changes, also terrific things happened in the world, of which we were a part, directly or indirectly. And we have engaged in all these troubles in the 33 years. And there are certain results. Today, but in medical science, but we contracted TB, galloping TB, and he had to go back, and he died at the age of 28. Then my mother came. She left me with my father's parents, and she came here to look for her fortunes, to find her fortunes here. But instead, she found terrible misfortunes. She had one misfortune after another. And my mother is actually not just a victim, a martyr of circumstances.
She's still alive?
Yes. She's in New York.
You were speaking about the other night, I imagined it was your mother, you said, who had been in some struggles, and when you were talking about the mother, she...
My mother had a struggle of her own. She wasn't in any struggles except her own.
Oh.
You see, and her struggle was funny and big. She fought a running battle with terrible conditions. Now, she insisted I should be in... Well, when I came here, I had no illusions about America. I read in stories and poems by a great Jewish poet, Morris Rosenfeld. When I was a kid, I used to read this and cry. Such a terrible things in the United States, the richest country in the world.
You read that back in your head?
Yeah. Sure. We all knew about these things. The sweatshops. And Morris Rosenfeld worked in the sweatshops and he wrote about it. He was a very fine writer. And his songs, there are lots of songs by him. Generally, the Jewish writers always reflected the reality of the sweatshops and the terrible conditions in their poetry and their stories. Now, I had no illusions, but I never thought that I would come to my mother and I would find my mother starving. There was no bread at times in the house. Actually, starvation conditions. She lived under starvation conditions.
Was she working?
Well,
the depression going on?
No. Store. A year after she married a man who had a business, and a year after she married him, she had two children. She had three with him. He took sick, and he lost a leg, and he had gangrene, and he was very sick all the time. He lost his arms, he lost his legs, and she had to support their family, and she had to keep a sick man alive. Now, she couldn't make it all by herself. It was impossible. That little store didn't carry. And she worked endless, actually endless hours. Now, when I came here and I saw this, and I was terrified. People envied me. I'm going to my mother. She's in business now. But I saw this. Well, I went to work right away. My ambition in life was at that time to go to school. I wanted to be a nurse. Why a nurse? I don't know, but I just wanted to be a nurse. You know, youngsters, I'm impressed by one thing today, I want to be one thing, and tomorrow I want to be something else. But instead I went to a millinery, my mother got me a job in a millinery shop. Why in a millinery shop? Oh, she thought millinery is a more refined trade. And she wanted her daughter, if she can, people knew me, and my people lived there for 200 years. And I was torn out of this, and I became sort of replanted, and I couldn't take to the new soil. Lots of people can. It takes a lot of time. I couldn't understand America. In front of the 42nd Street Library, and I'm jumping from one thing to another. And I came early, and I figured, oh, well, I'll go in and read some. You know, we were raised on Russian or Jewish literature. Then I came here, so I found out that there are other people who write nice things. But the American stuff, I didn't care for it. I just didn't understand it. Although I read it in translation, I didn't know English enough yet. But one day I had this other day, and I walked into the library because it was too early yet, and I hit upon Edgar Allan Poe. Story, somebody gets in a war, he gets, can't remember the story.
Is that the Fall of House of Usher?
No.
The cat.
Oh yeah, the cat. So I became so fascinated with the story, I forgot about my date, and I walked out. It was late in the evening, the library was about to close. My date. He's my husband today. So why was I so fascinated? I said to myself, here is one man. I wonder if he's American. He has the same depth as the Russian writers. Gee, he's almost like us today. And the people are so poor, and I work such a late hours.
How many hours a day
did
you work?
Oh, we worked at this place, the first place where I got into, we worked from 8 to 6, and Saturday all day. But there was a woman, an American woman. Had a very nice face, and very clever and energetic. You know, she never said anything to us, but never. As soon as she came into the workroom, it became as silent as in a morgue. And the workers seemed to be afraid of her. And when I first came in, we never heard how she appeared. But never, only when somebody turned her head, girls, there she was. And I used to hear somebody say, six. I couldn't understand why they say the six. But I was new, so I figured, well, maybe it's a play like that. You see, six was a sort of a sign that she's here and everybody should stop talking. Then I found out why they are afraid of her. She never says anything. Sure, she never says anything, but she calls you into the office. She's very smart. And then she lets you have it. And many times it ends in losing your job. She only has to catch you talking several times, three times. She gives you a chance. Don't think of it. I said, well, what about the girls anyway? I mean, every time I spend time with her, I introduced it from a different angle. It shouldn't be hard on her nerves, you see. She says, the girls, well, they don't give a damn about the girls to begin with. Then there is a group of girls. They are trying, but don't get mixed up with them. Well, one fine day, when my shop moved uptown, we were on the east side, a group of men came in to work on. He said, girls, everybody has to stop. The opera has already started. You have to come just to the union. We are the union. Boy, was I happy. Gee, wasn't that wonderful? So there is a union. So we all went out. And of course my boss, she didn't like this stuff, and she didn't want to sign up. After some time she signed up with a man.
Everybody went out, though. So.
Yes, everybody. She signed up with a man, but she refused to sign up for the girls. And the girls didn't understand. They didn't like any actually. They all went back. I was a greenhorn. I signed up. I was serious about it. I paid my initiation fee and I got a book. And I thought everybody else did it. So before they went out to work, boss took them into the office and she asked every one of the girls whether they belonged to the union. And they assured her that they didn't. And they didn't. They just said industrial unionism. They fought for amalgamation after. They have the most wonderful lectures on literature, discussions on books, poetry. One of our business agents was a woman of an intellectual bent, you know, and she used to teach us the values of poetry, gather us in her house before a fireplace on Sunday evenings and read poetry to us. We used to have lectures on the theater. Carl Sklar came to talk to us, and many other writers. And we carried on. We didn't only work for ourselves. We helped other things. We participated in everything. Like, for example, we had a Tom Lehman Buildings Committee for the defense of Tom Lehman Buildings. Then came the great Sacramento City struggle. We fought for it. And we made a stoppage to save their lives. And we had the millinery girls, when they used to see us in the street, they said, "Don't touch them. These are the millinery kids." Our affairs were the most beautiful. Everybody wanted to come to our balls and dances. Summertime, we had the excursions. And hikes and all these wonderful things, and we were young, you know. So everything was wonderful altogether. Then came the split within the labor movement. And we were expelled from there for that. Cases, we resisted very much. And in some cases, we were pulled up by police. They sent up the cops. And for about 2-3 years, our market was like an unkempt. We were struggling. We wanted amalgamation, weak representation, that we amalgamate all the robots, form an industrial union base, and we should be represented. Now, the Everwell leadership didn't like the whole scheme, and they declared us a bunch of lipstick and silk stocking girls. They called us the lipstick girls. That we don't work for a living anyway, we only work for lipstick, silk stocking. I listened to this kind of speech. I said, my God, I work for a living, I didn't even use lipstick. And in fact, I didn't wear a silk stocking, I couldn't afford it. How can the leader, the president of our international, say such a thing right in our face? Naturally, lots of the girls went with us, and many went with them. They were forced to go in. We are not the lipstick girls, we are premature. Well, bitten by gangsters. They used to bring down strong armed men. Our girls still carry the marks of the beatings, and some of them died. One of our girls was kidnapped and raped in a police station. And there were frightening things going on, but we carried on. Well, then boys, we were driven into the FFL, one by one. We couldn't hold out. And those that I named the ringleaders were put on a blacklist. And they gave us a book, a union book, that was temporary. It was a permanent list. Temporary book. We used to call it a yellow passport. Like during the Tsarist times in Russia, the Jewish girls, they wanted to go to the university or college, they had to get a yellow passport to register as a prostitute. That's what we paid you, all the taxes. They wouldn't give us a job. And sometimes they couldn't get out of it. They used to send us out to a shop, call up the employer and tell, listen, we sent you a woman, but she's a terrible wreck. Don't take her. You don't have to take her. And I never did. We were going to starve us out. We couldn't hold any office, no challenge, not a wonderful person. In the morning was going to take his two little children to school. And the gangsters planted a bomb in the motor of his car. And this wonderful Langer was his name. Torn, shreds. So,
is he in the Furriers?
Furriers. There we were, standing guard over Langer's young, torn body, and we pledged ourselves not to rest until we will bring about a day where industrial unionism shall become a reality. And we struggled out. We still carried out. And the gangsters terrorized us, beat us. One of the business agents of the Furriers wants the big picket line. We were out in the thousands. They cut his throat with a broken bottle. Gross. Young man. And he died as a result of that a few years later. Of the salespeople in Orbex and in Klein. And then one day, That was before Lando yet, though. He was the first one. In broad daylight, before God and all the people, they killed Steve Katugis. And 20,000 of us marched to his funeral. And we pledged ourselves again that we shall never allow this gangsterism to live and go on in this country. And then there was the great fighting the painters, also racketeering and gangsterism, where Weinstadt, this wonderful leader of the painters, running around, was fighting a terrible battle against terrible exploitation and racketeers. Well, we're trying to organize and show to not only to the people of the United States, to the whole world, under what terrible conditions they live. And the textile strikes aroused the conscience of America and they had tremendous demonstrations and mass meetings. And then one day, Ella May Biggins was killed. She was one of the great fighters, a mother to children. Ella May Biggins became the mother courage of the textile workers. You see, all along, we kept on paying for our progress. Although at that time it didn't look like progress. It looked like just plain struggle and fight. It was a war to a finish. The crash came. And little by little our factories began to empty out and the workers were standing in the market. Idle hands said, nobody wants to buy them. And we again started struggle to organize the unemployed. And this organization, little by little, culminated into the great demonstration in front of City Hall, where Mayor Walker told us to eat cake if we have no, eat ice cream if we have no bread. Eat cups on the horses, trampling over men and women and children. And there, our leaders were arrested, thrown into prison, and we went back to our determination to organize the unemployed, and we did. We fought a terrific battle for relief against eviction, against these terrible bread lines. And you know, I'll tell you something, I want to digress a little bit. My hometown. Very hungry. In Poland, they live in Warsaw. But believe me, the hardest thing in the world to be hungry, the hardest place in the world to be hungry is in the United States. There, because there is the knowledge that you are living in the richest country in the world. Then you walk in the streets and you see stores full of wonderful things, bakeries full of the most wonderful bread and all kinds of things. You see restaurants, you see all these things, and you know you worked for it. Why shouldn't you be able to have a little piece of bread that you worked for? There, you can't have it. So it's awfully hard, and then you feel terribly insulted. Your spirit gets so insulted that it's frightening. Maybe some people are not conscious of it, that their spirit is actually insulted. not only the body. So if, and with it, there is such a terrible loneliness about it. Generally, a poverty breeds loneliness. Terrific loneliness in poverty. That doesn't mean that poor people don't fight. I live on the East Side, and in spite of all our poverty and hardship, we laugh too, believe me, we laugh. So, there we were, struggling then. And I somewhat got tired of walking around without brick, being blacklisted that way. And I wanted to see the country. I had a terrific desire to see the country. I wanted to see America. So I went hitchhiking. And I saw lots of things. Very good things too. The good things I found in the people. Wonderful. Generous, big-hearted, somewhat naive. Well, of course, I was used to different types of people in my home. The Russian peasant is philosophical and it's different. Here I wasn't dealing with peasants, I was dealing with farmers who lived in more or less nice homes. And they had better conditions. But some of them weren't rich. They were poor and worked hard. And I saw wonderful cities of the United States. I stopped in many cities. I lived in Chicago and carried on a big struggle there. I attended demonstrations in Chicago, running Floyd, where I had seen big tanks, cops, like moving tanks, attacking the workers. And in Chicago, you know, the workers are very militant. They fought back. And you know, it was really something to see how the workers fought. In the bookstores, they terrorized. They beat up people. They broke into homes. And they did all kinds of terrible things. You wouldn't think that Los Angeles was in the United States. You would think that Los Angeles was on the outskirts of Berlin during Hitler's time. Demonstrations anyway, even though the Red Squad beat us up. And we carried out, we fought in spite of the Red Squad. Then came Upton Sinclair with his epic movement. By God, it carried. You would think that a whole world went after it. Los Angeles was just moving fast after Upton Sinclair. Mm-hmm. You see, from the organizational angle, point of view, from the get-together point of view, people learned to get together and here and there there were a few unions. There were some unions, building trades, and teamsters. But as a whole, Los Angeles was an open shop center and a vicious one. Organization. There was all kinds of organizations. And the remnants of Upton Sinclair's utopians, they call themselves. Well, carried on the struggle for a long time for unemployment insurance, and then there was Roosevelt came in and things changed. So Roosevelt came in before I got to Los Angeles, and here I want to say there was the Wagner Act came in, there was the upsurge of organization. So we went to them help. We used to concentrate on their garages. Help them organize. We came there with leaflets, with pamphlets, with open air meetings. He talked to them. It took a number of years. At times he became discouraging, but we quickly regained our courage. We didn't let ourselves into ideas of giving up. We went there just the same. And one fine day, the taxi drivers went out on strike. And what a strike this was. There was something very, very wonderful about this strike. New York looked gay because of the taxi driver strike. And we were all happy, and we right away ran around with cans to collect money in the factories and in the markets, and help in the relief. And naturally the bosses didn't want to sign up, and they stuck out until they'll sign. We provided them with plenty of relief and plenty of help. And then a strike was almost at an end, it was already at an end. Waiting for Lefty came to us, just like that. He came, and those who were busy, active in the strike, were invited to see their first performance. Waiting for it. And you should see how happy we were. We danced for joy. And there they introduced the author, a young man. Oh, our own. We made him. We gave birth to him. We. And all the love and all the warmth and all, I mean, everything we had in us, we heaped upon him. And there we thought, here he came. He'll tell us about all our struggles. He'll put it in his fine artistic way and bring it to us. And we just cherished him. We nursed him along. He was our baby. Well, today everybody knows the results of our baby. He left us. We get along very well without him. I don't know how he gets along without us.
Very poorly, you can see that. But
from his work, we see that he is a lonely man. Oh, well, he has maybe more refined company than we are. He has lots of money, but the money doesn't give him our work. He'll never have it. And what he did to us, I mean, what he gave us in return for all our warmth, we'll never forget. We'll never forget this. We'll never forget the good things, waiting for Lefty, and we'll never forget his pointing with his fingers at other people. We provided the great themes at that time for able writers. Ground Stream, which was fine, wonderful thing. But of course, out of these struggles, not enough books, stories came out. Maybe they'll come yet. I hope along the great struggles. I don't want to leave out the role of our women in America. You know, a few weeks ago, I went to see that play, Mother Courage.
We're going tonight.
It's a good play. Has some shortcomings. It's a good play from the point of view that it exposes war and all the futility of war. But in my opinion, it's bad that at this time, when we went through two world wars, and the women played a big role in these wars. We always do play a role because we have to. Women are more than half of the human population. So we have to take our place in history. We help to create it. Without our help, history wouldn't be complete. Now, they portrayed a woman, her way of making a living, Mother Courage, by black marketeering. No, I don't say that during wars, and even now, it doesn't take place in society. Sure it does. But today, it's a different proposition. Are women being engaged in racketeering? Are women? Were wets. They were waves. It showed the women in a war for existence through black marketeering, I think, is very wrong. Because people in general have changed their ideas about war. There's greater patriotism today. We lose a lot more because we have more to lose. And then the working people don't engage in racketeering during the war. They work for victory in the plants and factories and all over they produce. So from this point of view, I think mother courage today is sort of a contradiction. Although at that time it was not. Now as far as our women are concerned, you know, I have seen women of several countries. Every land has their mother courage, their wonderful women, we know that, and so does America. Why American women are relegated in literature to almost no position, almost to a very minor role, this I don't know. I think they deserve a great big place in literature. As I have pointed out already before, I like to see the mother of America in its proper place in literature. Now, look, during wartime and during peacetime, our women go to work. They are fighting a continuous battle. They work today working in a factory with all the modern machinery. It's still not easy because the speed up is horrific. We produce more today in 7 hours than we did in 12 once upon a time, you see. The women take care of their families. They have to run home, make dinner, prepare breakfast, prepare lunches for the husbands and for the children. And then there is the strain of sitting at work and thinking, what are my children doing at home? They are alone. They are on their own. This in itself is a terrific strain. Yet, our women are right there. They work. They attend their union meetings. They engage in a lot of struggle. And on the top of all that, they look nice. They are neat, clean, nicely dressed. When I watch them, many times I go down from work and I stop in front of a building on Market Street. I see, look at our women. They run. They don't go. They run. They have to. They have to make dinner for them. And yet, you wouldn't think they are running from a day's work, from factories and offices. And you know, they work from the minute they open their eyes till the minute they go to sleep. They are continuously working. And when it's slow and when they are laid off, they work too. They sew for their families, they do their own sewing, they clean, they are always working. And some of them, many of them, belong to different organizations like PTA and all number of things in our struggles for the improvement of conditions and progress, how much our women have contributed. And all throughout history we had our mother courage. But the fight against slavery, we had great mother courage of the Sojourner Truth, of what's her name?
Tubman.
Harriet Tubman. We had many more. And today we have a modern Mother Courage. Like I pointed out, Ella Mae Wiggins, Ethel Rodenberg, Helen Sobel, Mother Sobel, Rose Sobel. All these women have given us a lot of courage and have shown not only to us, but to the whole world, the stuff our women are made of, the moral and ethical quality of the stuff they are made of, the courage and the great spirit. Take Helen Sobel, for example, in this trying time, a time when we sat in factories and we were afraid to talk to the next worker, when we had to take up a shop problem or a union problem or anything, we had to think twice. Should I talk to her about it or shouldn't I? Looked at her with suspicion, a person with whom I worked for so many years. Many people, should I talk to them about it or shouldn't I? Our government or our leading circles have brought about a situation where we were scared to talk to people we knew, to some of our friends, to Rosenberg, who led not only us but the whole world from her death cell. She called upon the world to fight for decency, for a new type of morality, for a morality where a man should never point a finger against his fellow man. She called upon us for peace, to fight for peace, to struggle for everything that is beautiful, everything that is pure. She represented, and many other women in American life represent this purity and this great courage. And I think we should be very proud of them. They are our Mother Courage, like Gorky's mother was their Mother Courage. Yet, they haven't portrayed our women with a flag in their hands, and our women carry that flag in their hands. Ethel died with a flag, with the American flag in her hands. Helen Sobel carries forward that flag by fighting for her husband, for the injustice committed against her husband. Other women in different periods of American history carry their flag in their hands. And due to all this trouble, all this courage today, we are enjoying better living conditions. We are enjoying 7-hour day, 35-hour week. They're enjoying unemployment insurance and social security, all the pension, although they are trying to take it away from us, and we are not going to let them, I'm sure. And I'm sure that our women will struggle for it, to keep it, side by side with our father courage. They will. I'm confident about that. And in every turn of life, our women contribute so much. Now let's take the post-war period. We fought a world war. We fought against the scourge of fascism. They tried to Hitlerize us here too, but we didn't let them. And our women played a great role. I wish I could tell you how much we have done, how much we have demonstrated against fascism in front of embassies, in front of consulates. Who carried the placard against fascism? Women. Who carried these great demonstrations that we had, May Day demonstrations or unemployment demonstrations? Our demands on placards, our hopes, our dreams that are today reality. Women. So, and since the post-war period, we were all happy that we defeated fitted fascism. We got rid of Hitler, and we were dancing for joy. And we thought everything was going to be fine. We had this great, wonderful thing happening in San Francisco, the building of the United Nations. And men and women were happy, and they worked for it. And it was a holiday for us, because here we are going to create a situation where wars will be no more. And we all hoped, and we all did everything possible to keep this situation, so we shall be friends with people, not to shoot at each other and kill each other. Our sons of other countries, they are also sons of mothers. And our women and mothers and fathers, we are all happy. But we hear from across the channel, and he made a speech in Fulton, Missouri, and suddenly our climate changed. It became terribly cold, and we began to suspect everybody, not only abroad, but here too. We suddenly became afraid of our neighboring. We fought against this terrible thing. In America, there were still brave people who had the courage of their conviction to get up and raise their voices, call upon the people to tell them the truth, that our security is not in danger. And the leaders didn't jump from windows. We kept our balance through this fear and hysteria. All right, lots of people retired within themselves. Will come to an end. And it did to a certain extent. Last year, the new hope was born. Dark days.